I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. The U.S. State Department said on Tuesday that President Joe Biden's administration has concluded Israel is not currently impeding assistance to Gaza and therefore is not violating U.S. law, even as Washington acknowledged the humanitarian situation remained dire in the Palestinian enclave. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin in an October 13th letter gave their Israeli counterparts a list of specific steps that Israel needed to do within 30 days to address the worsening situation in Gaza. They said in the letter that failure to do so may have possible consequences on U.S. military aid to Israel. The deadline mentioned in the letter expired on Tuesday, and State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel said Israel had taken steps to address the demands, and Washington would continue to assess the situation. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees warned on Tuesday that famine is imminent in northern Gaza and may be already happening. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner reports.
Luis Waterage is the Senior Communications Officer for the United Nations Relief Works Agency, or UNRWA.
Aid supplies have worsened, they have lessened. The month of October, it was an average of 37 trucks a day into the Gaza Strip. 37 trucks a day for a population of 2.2 million people who need absolutely everything. It's not enough.
She says aid trucks into the strip had fallen in October and that no food was allowed to enter northern Gaza for an entire month. Israeli forces have been pushing deeper into north Gaza for more than a month, surrounding hospitals and shelters and creating fresh waves of displacement. They say the operation is designed to prevent Hamas fighters from regrouping there.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. This is VOA News. People in the southern Chinese city of Zhuhai on Tuesday paid tribute to victims after a ramming attack at a sports center that killed and injured dozens of people. Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaprin reports.
The incident happened Monday night when a driver rammed his car into a crowd at a sports center. Dozens of people were knocked to the ground. A video posted on social media showed chaotic scenes on the road after the incident. At least 35 people died, and 43 people were severely injured. Local police said the suspect is a 62-year-old man. Authorities say he attempted to flee but was apprehended by police at the scene. Police say the suspect had harmed himself using a knife, causing severe neck injuries. He was being treated at a hospital. Police said a preliminary investigation suggested the incident was triggered by the suspect's discontent following a divorce. The attack sparked an outcry on Chinese social media, but angry comments about the official delay in reporting the incident were removed, and the Weibo messaging site censored a hashtag that mentioned the death toll.
Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaprin. Donald Trump has spent his first week as U.S. president-elect largely out of public view. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
It's conspicuous for a man who loves the spotlight. Trump has stayed at his Florida club, working with advisors and others behind closed doors to build his administration. It's a cutthroat process, which one former White House official still close to Trump compares to Game of Thrones. The president-elect's expected back in public Wednesday here at the White House to talk with President Biden and on Capitol Hill for a chat with House Republicans.
That would be a great meeting and a moment for all of us. There's a lot of excitement, a lot of energy here.
House Speaker Mike Johnson says the GOP is ready to hit the ground running and deliver on what he calls America's mandate. Sagar Magani at the White House.
U.S. federal aviation officials are suspending American flights to Haiti. AP correspondent Haya Panjwani reports.
The Federal Aviation Administration is stopping U.S. airlines from flying to Haiti after gangs shot at a Spirit Airlines flight. The rule is in place for 30 days. Bullets hit the plane as it was about to land in Haiti's capital of Port-au-Prince. Gunshots injured one flight attendant. It's part of a wave of violence in Haiti after the country swore in its new prime minister. I'm Haya Panjwani.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 13, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Russia has reportedly deployed up to 200 military instructors to Equatorial Guinea.
When you have Russians in Equatorial Guinea, it means the rule of law completely is undermined, right? And it means the security of Americans over there can also be at stake.
Guinea-Conakry authorities launched a 30-day new constitution awareness campaign. In Liberia, it was business as usual on Tuesday, at least so it seemed, in the divided national legislature. The United States congratulates Mauritians and their new prime minister for dedication to democratic principles.
Dr. Navinchandra Ramgoolam is officially the new Prime Minister of Mauritius. He served as Prime Minister from 1995 to 2000 and again from 2005 to 2014.
And Nigerians seek bargains at thrift stores amid rising prices. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. As U.S.-based human rights activist from Equatorial Guinea says, the alleged Russian military presence in the country could undermine the U.S. presence geopolitically and business-wise. Reuters news agency quotes sources on Tuesday as saying that Russia has deployed up to 200 military instructors to Equatorial Guinea in recent weeks to protect the presidency. This comes as Western influence in Western Central Africa is declining and Russia's presence is increasing. Equatorial Guinea's 82-year-old leader, Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbasogo, is the world's longest-serving leader. Tutu Alicante is the director of EG Justice, or Equatorial Justice, a North Carolina-based rights organization that focuses exclusively on the country. He tells me that there is some credibility to the report.
I think in general, the main argument is in fact correct, right? There were a few things that I thought were incorrect, but as a whole, it is true that Russia has increased its physical presence on the ground, not just by having an embassy, but now having these 200 armed military men in the country. A couple of weeks after these men landed in Equatorial Guinea, there was a Navy ship that docked on the port in Malabo, and they had a huge parade, military parade in Malabo. So it tells you that Russia is definitely flexing its military and economic muscles on the ground in Equatorial Guinea for sure.
If the Russians are in Equatorial Guinea, who do you think might have invited them?
I think a couple of things. One is the express request from the Obiang to have military men protecting them, right? So I think that definitely play a key role. And secondly, the availability, though dwindling, of still some oil and gas that this AFRICORPS can use as payment for the services. It's astounding to me to know that, you know, the advertisement that this article mentions to Russian soldiers saying between $3,000 and $5,000 will pay to you monthly if you decide to go to Equatorial Guinea. That is a lot of money. Equatorial Guinea, I don't think, has cash. You know, so clearly, they're finding other ways to pay these 200 men they have landed there.
What could this mean for U.S. interests in Equatorial Guinea and U.S.-Equatorial relations?
I think more importantly is, what does this mean for democracy in Equatorial Guinea? What does this mean for the well-being of the people of Equatorial Guinea, right? And what this means is that for the foreseeable future, democracy is something that's not going to be present in the lives of most Equatorial Guineans. And with that comes the inability of most Equatorial Guineans in the foreseeable future to have a decent standard of living. In terms of the U.S., as you know, up until recently, had been concerned about the fact that China had expressed interest in building a naval base in Equatorial Guinea. Right now, not only do they have to worry about China, but they have to worry about the fact that now Russia has armed military men in the country. It strikes me as something that is going to undermine U.S. presence geopolitically and otherwise. You know, businesses American businesses, you know, as you know, Exxon is no longer there, and other American businesses are going to be looking at this place as increasingly less safe, less secure, both from the standpoint of security, you know, as well as from the standpoint of rule of law. So when you have Russians, whether they are directly connected to Kremlin or directly connected to Africa or others, in a place like Equatorial Guinea, it means the rule of law completely is undermined, right? And it means the security of Americans over there can also be attacked.
Tutu Alicante is the director of EG Justice of Equatorial Guinea Justice, a North Carolina-based human rights organization. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. The United States has congratulated the people of Mauritius and their newly elected government for what the State Department calls their dedication to the democratic process. His statement says the U.S. looks forward to working with Prime Minister-elect Navin Ramgoolam on strengthening bilateral ties. Prime Minister Ramgoolam's ADC coalition won a landslide victory in Monday's parliamentary election. Just who is Prime Minister Ramgoolam? I put that question to Davina Murdan, a Mauritian independent political scientist based in Pretoria, South Africa.
As we speak, Dr. Navin Chandra Ramgoolam is officially the new Prime Minister of Mauritius. He served as Prime Minister from 1995 to 2000 and again from 2005 to 2014. This is also the second time he has secured victory by winning all 60 directly elected seats, replicating his success with one of the political parties he allied with in the 1995 elections, that is, with the Mauritian Militant Movement, MMM. The Alliance for Change was further strengthened by the inclusion of two additional center-left social democratic parties, Résistance et Alternative and Nouveau Démocrate.
Why do you think he was able to defeat Prime Minister Junot by such a wide margin? What do you gather from the voters in terms of why they voted for the new Prime Minister?
The moustache leaks, the phone-tapping scandal certainly contributed to the defeat of Pravin Jugnaut and his government. However, the moustache leaks were only part of the story. Historically, Mauritians have never voted the same alliance or party into power for three consecutive terms. From a political science perspective, this trend may stem from a natural shift that occurs when an alliance holds power for more than 5 years. Its members often become increasingly attached to power. This tendency was evident in Pravin Jugnaut's government, which over the past 5 years grew increasingly distant and unresponsive, failing to protect both the civil and political rights as well as the socioeconomic rights of its citizens. Pravin Jugnaut's government also appeared to be moving away from the Western model of democracy toward an Asian-style democracy or soft authoritarianism. At one point, Mauritius seemed to shift from a democracy to an oligarchy, with power concentrated in the hands of a small elite group. In my view, while Jugnaut might not have lost the election solely because of these issues, the Moustache League significantly bolstered the Alliance for Change, helping them to secure all 60 seats. The current concern, however, is that this victory has left Mauritius with a weaker position, raising questions about its capacity to provide effective checks and balances moving forward.
Davina Murdan is a Mauritian independent political scientist based in Pretoria, South Africa. In Guinea-Conakry, the government has launched a 30-day nationwide campaign to increase public awareness of the new constitution. According to the chairman of the Transitional Council, the exercise is the first of its kind in Guinea, while the opposition says it's a waste of time. A referendum on the new constitution is expected in December. A time that the opposition says is also the end of the transition to civilian rule. Reporter Karim Kamara has more from Conakry.
The head of the National Transitional Council, Dr. Dasa Koroma, addressed diplomats, members of government and religious leaders here in Conakry before he launched in the town of Zerikou, 700 kilometers from Conakry, the 30-day campaign on the draft constitution. He says Guinea's people should be real guarantors of the constitution. He says that is the work they have started through this awareness campaign on the new draft document. He says if he understands better, this is the first time in Guinea that a draft constitution has been put before voters in a referendum. The referendum is expected at the end of the year, while the junta says the presidential election scheduled at the end of December to mark the end of the transition will now take place next year. The newly constitution consists of 205 articles, among which are age limit of 80 years for president, whose mandate will be limited to 2 years in office, and the creation of lower and upper houses of parliament for the first time in Guinea. Mohamed Lamine Kaba of the opposition says the newly constitution is full of shortcomings.
Quand on dit que la constitution n'est pas révisable avant 30 ans, alors que la vie politique, économique, sociale est en dynamique.
He says he rejects the proposal that the constitution cannot be amended for 30 years because political, economic and social life are dynamic. He says he was surprised to learn that even after a second term in office, a president has no right to propose constitutional changes even if he is backed by the people. For him, age limits are not important. He says what is important is the ability of the individual to rule the country. The age limit in the new constitution has irritated members of the opposition. They all call it a pretext to eliminate key opposition leaders in order to pave the way for the junta leader to be a candidate. Those directly affected by the age limit include former President Alpha Conde, the leader of the Rally of the Guinean People, and Sidya Touré, the head of the Union of Republican Forces Party. The main opposition leader of the party, Union of Democratic Forces of Guinea, Selun Dalenchello, is also not far from attaining the age limit. The opposition has vowed to make Guinea ungovernable if the military junta continues to rule beyond December. According to Edward Zotomo, a member of the opposition, the awareness campaign is a waste of state funds and mere tourism by members of the Transitional Council. It says the constitution is drafted to suit the junta leader.
This draft constitution was written by just a handful of people so that they can put in what the CNRD wanted in terms of the very article, the article that should not prevent them from presenting a candidate. Now today, they're preparing to go on a referendum, which is also going to take busloads of money. As you can see, this is all just a set up to drag on the transition so that they can avoid actually organizing elections.
General Mamadi Doumbouya seized power in a military coup in 2020. He promised to return the country to civilian rule at the end of 2024. He says neither he nor any member of the transition will be a candidate. But today, some doubt his promise. General Amara Kamara, the spokesman of the presidency, says, like any other Guineans, nothing can stop junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya from standing as a candidate in future elections. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm Jim Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 13. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In Liberia, it was business as usual, at least so it seemed, in the divided national legislature. A group of lawmakers claiming to be the majority in the House of Representatives held a hearing on Tuesday about allegations of bribery connected to the Speaker, J. Fonati Kofa. The Speaker is being forced out of his job by the so-called majority bloc for alleged corruption. He has refused to step down. This as a delegation from the Parliament of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, is in Liberia on a mediation mission. The incident has caused President Joseph Boakai to postpone the submission of the draft national budget for fiscal year 2025. Representative Fode Edward Fambule is a member of the Good Governance and Reform Committee and a member of the group calling itself, calling for Speaker Kofa's removal. He tells me that Speaker Kofa was not present, but a complaint against him was read.
Today we passed section, as was planned. We had the appearance of two ministers and an agency head. So today, yes, as the House conducted regular session.
Who presided over that regular session? The Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mr. Kofa, or who did?
What happened today was, one, the official communication against the Speaker. I had to do a complaint from some of our colleagues was read today. A special House committee was set up by plenary, and there was a motion for the Speaker to recuse himself officially, authorizing the Deputy Speaker to continue to preside while the investigation of the Speaker is being carried out. Because plenary own interest now is to provide or lay out a clear procedure that will grant the Speaker due process in keeping with our law controlling.
Speaker Kofa, did he attend this particular session?
He was absent as usual. He has not been able to come, but he was then communicated with. The Sergeant Arm has been informed, along with the Chief Clerk Office, that they should communicate with his office, and based on the return of said communication, a decision will be taken.
There is a delegation from ECOWAS, a mediation delegation. Did the session today receive any communication from that delegation?
Yes, the communication of ECOWAS was then open. The conversation was then open for other colleagues' thoughts in terms of how they see it before plenary could take a decision. Some of our colleagues expressed disappointment in the names involved in the mediation. They had reservation when it comes to Senator Snow, who they believe was conflicted. He has previously established a side as to when he stand on this issue. He could not be a suitable individual to play any mediation roles.
I read in the local media about some seats in the parliament being removed. What can you tell us about who removed them and why were they removed?
The first thing from the evidence available to us that it then stated that the chair on modernization on the state of Bupa was part of that process. The co-chair on judiciary on the road, Jerry Yoko, has been one name called in the process, alleged by the director of security from the Senate wing. As I speak to you, the director of security from the lower house line is currently before the police on ongoing interrogation as to who authorized the removal of those seats in the chamber, but from what we've been able to gather around, lawmakers have said that they have contracts. From evidence available to us, there was only contract available for the main chamber, not the joint chamber. So they have provided misinformation or disinformation to the public.
So I spoke with another member of the House of Representatives from the other side, I would say, who indicated that the Speaker was not being given a due process. Can you answer to that allegation?
As I said, we are in the process of giving the Speaker due process. We support what the law provides. There is a formal communication and an order campaign against the Speaker. That communication will be served the Speaker today, and the Speaker will need to make himself available for the investigation. There's a specialized committee investigating him. For me, I think the best thing to do is to be able to listen to his side.
Another criticism is that you people are not really doing the Liberian people's business by this ongoing confusion in the House of Representatives. So answer to that, are you doing the people's business?
The answer is that yes, we are doing the Liberian people's business. Evidence from the oversight responsibility of the legislature would invite the ministers and their appeal. It is the Speaker in his life who have not been able to come to session.
Representative for the Edward Fambule is the chair of the Government and Reform Committee in the Liberia House of Representatives. He was speaking with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia, where prices rising, Nigerians are becoming creative. Thrift shopping, locally called Ikrika, is booming, offering affordable options. Gibson Emeka from Abuja looks at how this market is becoming a lifeline for many in Nigeria.
For years, 30-year-old Agatha Okori, a successful businesswoman in Abuja, shopped at upscale boutique. But with the pricing of new clothing more than doubling, she now turned to second-hand shop for more affordable options. Okori says thrift clothing let her keep her style without breaking the bank.
I moved from buying brand new clothes to buying thrift because, one, aside the cost, streetwear are more durable. And like we all know, brand new clothes are quite on the high side. They are quite expensive, way more than thrift wear. That's why they switch to thrift.
Okori is not alone. Once reserved for low-income shoppers, thrift shopping has become mainstream. Known locally as Okrika, thrift markets from Lagos to Abuja are boosting. Economist Isaac Botti notes that for many, thrift shopping is a necessary response to inflation and policy that leave them stretching every dollar.
So they do all of this as a means of survival because the government is not helping, the economic situation is not helping, the federal government policies are not favorable to consumers. So it is two ways. A means of affordability for the consumer and a means of boosting sales for the sellers.
Andrew Eze, who is 32, have seen this shift in fashion firsthand. When prices on new clothing surge, he switched to selling thrift wear in Abuja famous Nyanya Okrika market. Eze says this has helped his business stay afloat.
The time came that the brand new became so high, that is the amount, the price in the market is so high that many cannot afford to get it at that price.
Studies show Nigeria imports more than 500,000 tons of second-hand clothing yearly. But even these alternatives feel the pinch as rising import costs push some thrift vendors to raise prices. For many, like civil servant Chris Olofu, this means further compromise on quality and style to stay on budget.
Because in those days that economy was very good, we used to buy from high-profile boutiques. Because there's a way we classify ourselves. Living an ostentatious life. But because of the economy, the efficiency in the economy now, it has made me at least to cut my clothes according to my size. But though, if the economic condition improves, I have to stop. I have to go back to my normal fashion.
Experts agree that thrift shopping will likely remain popular as long as economic pressure exists. This trend impacts Nigeria's local textile industry due to competition with affordable imported clothing. Button believes investing in local textile production could eventually make a new clothing more affordable. But until then, thrift shopping remains essential.
Government needs to invest in the sector, subsidize their operations, help to relieve the burden, the cost of production, burden of the cost of production on the manufacturer. That will translate to lower cost of production and cost of sales, which is the real opportunity.
As Nigeria adapts to the changing economy, thrift market provide affordable option. Gibson Emeka, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Ghana's Supreme Court has ruled that the parliamentary speaker's declaration of 4 seats as vacant was unconstitutional. The move effectively restored the ruling party's majority in the legislature ahead of the December 7th election. Last month, 2 members of parliament from the ruling New Patriotic Party, the NPP, and 1 from the biggest opposition party, the National Democratic Congress, the NDC, announced that they would run as independent candidates in the election, while an independent candidate joined the NPP. Senegalese Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko on Tuesday called for vengeance following what he described as attack against supporters of his Pastef party by the opposition during the campaign for parliamentary elections. And that's all this Wednesday, November 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton, Washington.
Presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in Brief airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source